Good day and welcome to Dissecting the NSA Review Group Report with Professor Peter Swire. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Dipal Shah. Please go ahead.
Thanks for joining today's call, Dissecting the NSA Review Group Report, Liberty and Security in a Changing World. I'm Dipal Shah, and I am Director of Policy Development and Programming here at ACS. Just weeks ago, an elite five-person review group appointed by the President issued a highly anticipated report, Liberty and Security in a Changing World. The report, 300-page compilation of 46 separate recommendations, called for major reforms to the recently exposed and hotly debated NSA surveillance and data mining program. Our speaker today, Peter Swire, a member of the review group and esteemed privacy expert, has joined us to discuss the program, the report, and related issues of national security privacy, as well as our Constitution. Professor Swire is the Nancy J. and Lawrence P. Huang Professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Previously, he was C. William O'Neill Professor of Law at the Moritz College of Law of Ohio State University. Professor Swire is also a senior fellow with the Future of Privacy Forum, the Center for American Progress, and policy fellow with the Center for Democracy and Technology. A leading and renowned expert on all matters technology and privacy, Professor Swire has served both the Clinton and Obama administrations and was tapped to serve on the President's five-person review group on intelligence and communications technologies last summer, which recently unveiled their report. Professor Swire is going to offer moderated remarks for about 15 to 20 minutes, and then we'll take questions. The operator will instruct you how to ask a question, and if you're a member of the media, please identify the outlet you represent. Additionally, you can receive 0.5 hours of CLE credits for this call. If you would like to receive credit, please email Katie O'Connor at katieoconnor@acslaw.org. Also can be found on our website. So let's begin. Professor Swire, thank you again for participating in today's call. I'd like to talk for a few minutes with you about the genesis of the report. If you could just give us some background, why did the President commission the report, and what was the process the group went through to create it?
Well, sure, and thanks, Dipal, for hosting this, and ACS for all the good work you guys do in having an informed debate around these legal and constitutional issues. For me, I was quite surprised in August one day to get a call from Lisa Monaco, who's a lead anti-terrorism and homeland security advisor to the President, to say, would I be on this review group? I didn't know what was going to happen. And it turns out the President wanted to have, in addition to the internal clearance process that goes on within the agencies, he wanted to have a set of people do this independent review. And the group he put together in late August included Michael Morell, who's formerly deputy director of the CIA, so 30 years in the intelligence community, Richard Clark, who had been a senior anti-terrorism and cybersecurity advisor both to Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush, and a good technologist along with the rest of things, Cass Sunstein, who doesn't need much introduction to most legal people in ACS, and Jeffrey Stone, who former dean at the University of Chicago Law School and very involved with ACS as well. And then I was included, I think, especially because of my privacy and technology background. So we met with the President in the Situation Room in August and his senior national security advisors, and he released a charge. He ordered us or asked us to take on the following. He wanted to have recommendations on what we should do in the wake of all these disclosures and as a review of the sort of surveillance programs 12 years after 9/11, what should we do in order to address national security? And as you heard in his speech last Friday or in the State of the Union last night, it's absolutely important in a dangerous world to have the ability to respond to threats and dangers. He also asked us to look at international relations. I think the discussions with Germany after Angela Merkel's phone calls, that's highlighted how we have allies in the world. They are strategic allies on intelligence things. We work together with them. And they're allies on many other levels, including will they have trust in the United States. We were asked to examine how to preserve privacy and civil liberties. So privacy you might think of as especially the Fourth Amendment kinds of questions. What about metadata, et cetera? Civil liberties includes political speech, freedom of association, the ability to have dissent. So that was part of our charge. He asked us what we could do to maintain public trust. That's the fourth thing in the list. And fifth is what to do going forward to address the insider threat, because Mr. Snowden, after the Manning leaks, had revealed quite substantial challenges. So that's an unusual smorgasbord of things to try to address: national security, international relations, privacy, civil liberties, trust, and insider cybersecurity threats. But that was our task. And the five of us got excellent, really unimpeachable support from the various agencies. The different agencies had people detailed over to us to support our work, so when we had questions, they could get answers. We worked on the report from August. We would meet one or two days a week in Washington through and finishing our report in early December, except when the shutdown happened. And so then we had an interim verbal briefing to the president's senior advisors about three quarters of the way through, and provided the report to the president by our deadline. We met with him for over an hour, again, in the Situation Room, and went through the recommendations. And that was mid-December. It was published shortly after that. And I think it was helpful, I hope it was helpful, in informing the president's own decisions in this area that he announced last Friday.
It's a lot of work went into this, and as I had mentioned before, it's 300 pages and has 46 recommendations. What can you say are, as you would see it, are the report's most important recommendations? And is it true that they were unanimous? Because that's been reported as well.
Let me do the last one first. It is completely true that it's unanimous. We had prepared for the possibility of disagreements, and so if we had three or four people who came to some point, we were prepared to drop a footnote and say who agreed or disagreed with part three or part four. But with this range of people, ACLU people, CIA people, cybersecurity people, et cetera, by working and talking, we came to views that we were all comfortable with. So every sentence in the report is backed by every one of the five of us. And this was not a horse trading exercise. This was the considered judgment of the group. In terms of the biggest recommendations, the one that's certainly gotten the most attention has to do with what's usually called the Section 215 telephone metadata program. The idea that we can say that, and it sounds like English to some people, shows how far we've come. But Section 215 of the Patriot Act authorizes the government to get records after a judge issues an order, including the general sort of order that have been applied for these telephone records. And this was a very large-scale program for the telephone records of domestic phone calls under the foreign intelligence authorities. And when this became public and confirmed by the administration this summer, I think ever since then that's been a real focus. Our recommendation was that this not be a database held by the government, that we thought the privacy and civil liberties issues around having this database and possibly a slippery slope towards other databases of domestic activities for anti-terrorism was not a good idea. And so we recommended either that we rely on phone companies, which have many of these records in the course of business, or perhaps create a third-party entity in the private sector. So that was a big one. There was a set of recommendations that the president decided not to take at this point around the structure of the National Security Agency. We recommended that Cyber Command, the military command combat structure, be separated from the NSA's foreign intelligence mission. We also recommended that there be changes when it comes to the offensive aspects of national security for cyber attacks, that we should separate out the defensive information assurance things into a separate agency. The president decided not to do that. There are synergies by having these together. But I think, at least in our group, we were concerned that the NSA structurally could be getting too many different jobs in one place without the proper set of checks and balances. And so maybe the next time Cyber Command comes up for review, it would be separated. We can hope for that. And then one other there's many others. We recommended transparency be substantially increased for the companies about what kind of requests they're getting. And we had various other recommendations to try to help lawful access work better. And these are moving forward. And this week, as many of you know, the major companies reached an agreement with the Department of Justice to make significant steps towards greater transparency about government lawful requests. We can do more, but those are at least three of the areas that have gotten a lot of attention.
So you've touched a little bit about what, and just to inform the audience in case they were unaware, the president did speak on the report recently, just a few weeks ago, and he stopped short of adopting all the proposed changes. You have indicated some of the things that he's willing to do. What did the president indicate that he was willing to authorize from the report, and how does it differ from the review group? Do you believe his actions are sufficient?
I think if anybody a year ago had seen the set of actions that President Obama did, they would have seen them as remarkably civil liberties, business-friendly changes to the whole process, major changes from where we could have been. And I think our group, our review group, helped contribute to that process. So I'm very favorable towards the extremely thoughtful and nuanced speech the president gave on this subject. I forget exactly I think that speech was very helpful. They've informed us that something like 70% of the recommendations out of the 46 they've taken either in letter or spirit. There's some others that they're studying. And I anticipate there will be additional announcements as we go forward about particular parts of our recommendations that haven't been announced publicly yet. So I think that they took this extremely, extremely seriously.
Also,
was there another part of the question I didn't get to?
Yeah, the other part was just how did anything that he actually speak on differ from the review group report? But I think you've answered that.
Add one thing that
right.
I think is interesting, and that so there's one area where the president went substantially beyond some things that we had said. This has to do with what kind of surveillance will be done towards non-U.S. persons. We have extra strict rules historically towards U.S. persons if they come up in the middle of these terrorist investigations. And the president issued a policy directive, presidential policy directive, which is up on the website in unclassified form, that said we're really going to treat especially our allies and ordinary people in other countries much more the way we've been treating ordinary American citizens when we do the course of these CIA and NSA intelligence reviews. And it's a remarkable document because instead of it only being citizens of the country and then a sort of free fire zone to spy on the rest of the world, which is the way spying has often been done, the president has taken on for the United States quite strong directives to build privacy and civil liberties into the integral structure of the intelligence community. And a lot of new work is going to be done to do what's called minimization for non-U.S. persons. So the ordinary citizens of other countries, think Europe in particular perhaps, will now, we can say, and I was in Brussels last week and was saying, that that this is a remarkable statement about providing institutional software-enforced safeguards that didn't exist before. So I think that's really worth people looking at as a new area that goes beyond what people had contemplated before.
He also specifically mentioned in one of his proposals that the government would no longer hold the metadata under the Section 215 metadata program, and that's something that's specifically called for in the report. Can you maybe speak to what that would look like and what a possible standard would be for the government to access that information, even if it's held by a third party?
So one of the changes for the standard is right now under the statute there has to be RAS, reasonable and articulable suspicion. That's less than probable cause. There has to be RAS before a particular person's phone number is looked at in the database. One of our recommendations was that a judge should check for RAS when that happens. Under previous practice, it was being done by people within the NSA, and a supervisor within the NSA would check on it. But now we're saying Article 3 judge would look at RAS, and the president agreed with that recommendation, and that's going into effect now. They're going to send it to the FISA court, is my understanding. In terms of how exactly the records will be held, we offered different alternatives in the report. We highlighted that many telephone records are held for 18 months already, and so you can go to those people for 18 months of records because they hold it in the normal course of business and maybe for longer in some companies' cases. There's been interesting developments. The Republican National Committee, seeming to be slightly different in this issue than it was after 9/11, unanimously by voice vote last week took the position that the entire program should be canceled. And this is an interesting time in politics and as in the sort of discussions where we see the sort of libertarian aspects of the Republican Party and libertarian aspects, civil liberties aspects of the Democratic Party, Senator Wyden or Senator Utah or whatever. And so exactly what mix of mending it or ending it will happen, I think, is extremely in play within Washington. For our review group, we said it shouldn't be held by the government. We were open to different ways for it to go forward. The debate may get past that, and one of the reasons is that the program is scheduled to sunset in May of 2015, a little over a year from now. And so Congress is going to get involved here, and exactly how it gets built will come from Congress, and it also will come in part from a 60-day review that Attorney General Holder and the Director of National Intelligence, Clapper, have to do. So I think there's going to be a lot of people really thinking about specific ways to build these records and what's going to be accessed and how. But I'd say it's remarkably in flux right now.
Piggybacking off of some of that, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board recently concluded just by a slim majority that the program was unconstitutional or illegal and should be shut down, as did at least one district court. And I was just wondering if you had thoughts on this.
Yeah, well, the PCLOB, Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, was co-housed with us. We are in the same classified facility on K Street. And I've worked with many of the members, some of them I've known for years and years. So I have great respect for what the PCLOB has done. Their policy recommendations, which they were developing independently, and we did not talk about what our recommendations were. We shared facts in some cases. Their policy recommendations were broadly consistent with what we recommended when it came to the 215 program, in terms of how to do more transparency and how to do a lot of the other pieces. And they had a unanimous agreement on many of the policy recommendations, and I think that hasn't been picked up by the press so much out of the report. They also did something that we did not take on as a task. We felt we had a lot to do with the 300 pages we wrote in a few months, so we did not do a constitutional analysis. And we did not come to a legal opinion parsing the statute to say what's permitted or not permitted under 215. We took on policy goals, and that's what we wrote about. The PCLOB, in addition, did a statutory analysis that came out more like Judge Leon, saying it's not authorized under the statute. And they did a constitutional analysis, basically saying these issues are in flux at the Supreme Court level. We may see a change in the Smith versus Maryland doctrine. But they did that in areas that we didn't go into. And so our group did not take on those tasks. We had a lot of other tasks we were doing.
So thank you. And that's it from me. Now we're going to turn it over back to the operator for questions and answers from our listeners. We'll be taking questions from the media first, so if there are any media questions first, we'll start there, and then we'll move on to the rest of our audience.
And at this time, to ask a question over the phone, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Once again, that's star one to ask a question. And once again, that's star one to ask a question. We'll take our first question from C.J. Camarello with the Washington Free Beacon.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I was wondering, at a National Press Club discussion, your fellow board member, Jeffrey Stone, painted a picture and said that the White House found the report, quote, or said the report, quote, as a liberal kind of report. And that the White House was being pressed sort of to the right on the issue by members of the intelligence community and other people they talked to after the report was released. And I was wondering if you agreed with that assessment or had anything you could offer in terms of context.
Yeah, thanks. I saw some reports about Jeffrey's speech, but I'm not commenting specifically on what he said because I don't have those words in front of me. So let me just say my own words about it. You know, I've worked in the White House twice, and there's this big process they call clearance where the different agencies come to views on things inside themselves, and then you have the interagency process coordinated typically by the White House. And then you get to some answer from the advisors, and if there's issues that have to go up to the president, they go up to the president. And that's completely normal sort of thing. And so as we were doing our report, and especially once our report came in December, the different agencies and the interagency process was very hard at work on their new homework assignment about what are these 46 recommendations and what should be done about them. And in our transmittal letter to the president, we talked about we're sending these in a manner of humility because we've had our review, but we don't know all the things that everyone knows. So in the clearance process, the agencies had criticisms, some of which were very valid, in my view. And it's also very normal for agencies to err on the side of the status quo. Change is difficult. Everything they do has been justified previously in a budget setting. And so I think that there's a natural lean towards the status quo in a process like this. I think that's one of the reasons the president wanted the five of us who are outsiders, but most of us with government experience, to prompt the process, to push the process farther than it would have otherwise. And so we issued our 46 recommendations, and the president in his speech and afterwards is taking roughly 70% of them, we've been told. And I think that's a very substantial amount of movement. I also think it's normal and expected when agencies lean towards what they've already been doing, and that was happening during this process as well.
Great. Thanks so much.
And we'll take our next question from Alexis with Bloomberg BNA.
Hi. I was wondering if you can respond to concerns that have been raised on the Hill about the idea of moving the phone records to the private sector. There's been a lot of concern about that this could create more privacy issues than you currently have. And Senator Rockefeller mentioned this at a Senate hearing today, for example.
Yeah. Right. This has been Senator Feinstein, and who's chairman on the Senate side for the Intelligence Committee, and Chairman Rogers on the House side, have expressed similar concerns. In terms of our review, one thing to emphasize is that phone companies hold phone records already, and the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, requires many important categories of phone records to be held for 18 months, especially for billing purposes if you have a billing dispute with the company that you can resolve it. The idea that phone companies would hold phone records is completely vanilla. It's not a new risk being added to the system. Depending on the length of time the records are held or depending on what structures are built, then there could be changes in what the companies have done, or there may be, as our report says, a new entity created. But it's off a baseline of existing practice. And then one other observation is that the NSA, unfortunately, itself has proven less than perfect on retaining its own records. So we do have the Snowden leaks. So it's not a baseline of perfection on the government side and problems on the private side. I think that I don't want to say it that way. I'm comfortable that we're not increasing the security and privacy risks with our proposals.
Thanks.
And as a reminder, it's star one to ask a question. We'll take our next question from David Scholes with Levine Sullivan.
Thank you. Professor Swire, I have a question. The review group spent a lot of time looking at the handling of metadata and how that should occur. There's been a number of other data collection programs disclosed. For example, it's been reported that the NSA is actively collecting address books and buddy lists and things like that, or collecting geolocation records and data center information. Did the review group consider these other types of programs and what should be done with them?
One observation is that address book information, or at least who you have chatted with, who you have had social network contacts with, that comes within the to-from information that we've understood as metadata. It's not the same as telephone metadata, obviously, because it's not the telephone.
Yeah, no, but The Washington Post has reported that there's actually a separate program where they will get into cell phones and sweep address books and contact lists and things, which is not metadata. It's a totally different set of data.
Right. So we were briefed on and did work on a wide range of programs under different legal authorities that included Section 702, which has to do with one end of the conversation is overseas, and also Executive Order 12333, which is a general authorizing structure for many of the intelligence community activities and signals intelligence. Many of these, first of all, not every report in the press is true. Just from reporting on a review group, I have my personal list of just factual errors about the review group that I could, if inclined, provide to you all. And so I would not assume that every report in the press on the leaked documents is accurate. With that said, there are many different programs that the NSA does in different parts of the world to try to keep us safe. And the Presidential Policy Directive that I described earlier has significant new safeguards that would apply to non-U.S. persons in addition to the safeguards that we've had in place for many years that apply to U.S. persons. And we also, in the course of our review, something I haven't mentioned in this call but important to it, recommended, and the President has said he will adopt, a new policy-level, White House-centered review of sensitive intelligence collection programs. So instead of it being purely, for instance, an NSA decision to go do a collection process that has sensitive, possible international ramifications or whatever, now you'll have economic officials and other officials outside of the traditional intelligence list looking at the collection programs and assessing it in terms of these broader sets of goals, the privacy and civil liberties goals, the economic goals, the strategic alliance goals, and so on. And so whatever programs go forward will not be simply maybe we'll find data and maybe it'll be helpful someday, but it'll be subjected to this sort of multifaceted review. So that's one of the changes that we said and that the President said he'd adopt. There are many programs that happen overseas. The Section 215 program was notable because it involved domestic-to-domestic phone calls under foreign intelligence authorities. And that mattered partly because it's ordinary Americans who vote and talk to their members of Congress. And it mattered also because of this sort of surprise that you'd have such a domestic collection under foreign powers of authorities. But there are many other programs, and we were briefed in detail on quite a range of them.
And as a reminder, it's star one if you'd like to ask a question.
We actually just had a question come in here. So I'll go ahead and ask it. Peter, Professor Sawyer, how do you respond to any criticism?
I'm Peter also, it's okay.
How do you respond to any criticisms of the report for vagueness and in the alternative for not going far enough?
I think the good fortune in retrospect that people had very low expectations for our report. If you read the press report in August, especially from the progressive side, there were do nothing, lackey of the administration, no independence at all, not calculated to really create any change. There was a whole series of expectations along those lines. The report came out in December. It was substantial, 300 pages. It was unanimous. And my sense is it's really helped to propel the discussion, both in that internal clearance process that we discussed for the administration and outside. I've been gobsmacked by people who know chapter and verse of the report and have engaged with me on it since it came out. So people have clearly engaged with it. Vagueness is not the thing you'd usually associate with 46 specific recommendations or 300 pages. There were times when we didn't want to speak beyond what we were confident that we knew about, and so we'd go a certain distance and not further. So that's something of vagueness. In terms of not going far enough, Well, one of the issues we said is that we should change national security letters so a judge is involved every step of the way. That was, I think, a big surprise to people as going further than many of them had thought. It was based on our view of how national security investigations over time need checks and balances from outside of just the executive branch. I think in many respects we've been seen as pushing farther than probably almost anyone would have guessed in the August report. It wasn't our goal to go farther, but it was our goal to respond to the president's charge, and we had these multiple goals we were trying to achieve. One way I say it sometimes is we have exactly one internet that we have to use. It's the internet that's used for surveillance, and it's the internet that's used for e-commerce, and it's the same internet, routers and software and hardware that's used for political speech and culture and YouTube and all the rest. And I think one reason the report has resonated with people is that it talks about the multiple risks, and it talks about why we need all these different chapters of the report to respond to this one communications infrastructure. We're 12 or 13 years after 9/11. We have a chance to look to see what our long-term structure should be here. And we're having a much bigger national conversation than I think most people might have anticipated. I think our report, being careful to say only things as much as we could that we believe were really, that we were solidly for and solidly documented, I think it's really advanced the discussion. Let me just mention one thing for lawyers. The press hasn't picked this up, but it's one of the little pieces of the report that I think could be useful to people going forward. There are several appendices to the report, and Appendix A does something that actually took a fair bit of work and doesn't seem to have existed before, and that's to lay out the legal authorities and the standards for the government getting records under the FISA kind of authorities and also under the law enforcement authorities. What's the standards for getting a pen register trap and trace order? What are the standards under 12333? What are the standards under 215 or 702 or the traditional Fourth Amendment or the Electronic Communications Privacy Act? And so for lawyers who have reason to work in this area, Appendix A to the report is purely descriptive, at least it's intended to be, and was cleared with the Justice Department for being accurate. They didn't get to tell us they liked it or didn't like it, but they tried to correct any mistakes they saw. That's at least one legal resource that might turn out to be useful for people trying to understand their way through this complicated area of the law. I'm open for other questions if there are any.
We have time for about one more. I have one here. Based on your review, Peter, would you say that the NSA program as it stands is unconstitutional? And what are your thoughts on cases in the district court?
Yeah, I haven't taken a public view on Peter Swire's view on the current 215 program. Here's what I say, and I'm comfortable saying. The government has built a very large structure of law based on the Smith versus Maryland precedent from the 1970s, where there's content, such as the content of a phone call, that requires a higher, usually probable cause warrant. And then there's this mere metadata stuff, like the phone records, that do not have constitutional protection and there's no reasonable expectation of privacy. This is also often lumped in as what's called the third party doctrine, where the individual consented to the records being sent on to other people. In the U.S. v. Jones case, Justice Sotomayor very explicitly said that she thinks the time may have come to revisit this doctrine. And there were four concurring justices led by Justice Alito whose opinion can also be fairly read, and we talk about this a little bit in our report, as heading in the same direction, saying technology has changed so much that some different way to handle this may make sense. So I think that if I were a district judge, I would have the challenge today that Smith versus Maryland looks like good law, and I would have the challenge today that five justices have given us fairly intriguing signs that the law may change. And it's exactly at that moment where your prediction of the future is different from the precedent from the past that judges have the hardest time trying to figure out how to act for the Supreme Court. So that's an observation. One thing we did in our report in that area is to say that we thought there should be a study, a further follow-on study on this whole area of metadata and exactly what legal structures and technological facts apply there. And the president has picked up on that, and he commissioned the PAB, which is the President's Intelligence Advisory Board, to do a follow-up study on metadata in the next fairly short number of months. Metadata is a word very few people used regularly 2 or 3 years ago. Now it's at the center of a national debate. And I think Smith versus Maryland, in my view, is a very aging, very brittle precedent to rely on. But exactly where the court will go and whether they'll know how to draw lines they're comfortable with is, I think, a great big challenge. And it may be one of the really big legal moments when the court does grapple with that, as I suspect they really might. Like, one other observation on the history of this. For telephone wiretaps, there was the famous Olmstead case in the 1920s, where the Supreme Court said, it's no constitutional protection. The police officer climbed up a telephone pole and listened to the phone record to the phone call in public from outside the home. There was no trespass. It's just fine. And that was a sort of, you've assumed the risk and there's no Fourth Amendment protection view of things. And then in Katz versus United States, the Supreme Court in 1968 or 67 said, it's persons, not places, that have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And then that changed. So for our emails, for instance, and other communications, up until now, the courts have been following an Olmstead approach, which is you've assumed the risk, you don't have any expectation of privacy, no constitutional protections, only statutory. But we may have a new time to overrule Olmstead. It may well be that the judges and justices understand the technology well enough or see the facts have changed enough that they have to do their version of Katz and Berger. Katz and Berger were accompanied by very intensive legislative activity. And the fact that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are both struggling with real changes to 215 suggests we have that legislative moment now also. So there's a very interesting historical parallel to the potential to get a Katz or Berger kind of decision to overrule the Olmstead kind of decision. And if that happens, it will grow out of exactly this metadata discussion. So I think it's a great big interesting issue, and the justices will have to really struggle to figure out where they draw the lines if they decide to shift from where they've been.
And at this time, we can start taking non-press questions. As a reminder, it's star 1 on your telephone keypad to ask a question. There are no other phone questions at this time.
Well, it looks like we are about out of time, so we can wrap up. Thank you again, Professor Swire, a.k.a. Peter, for joining us on today's call, and to all of our listeners. The call will be available on our website soon, MP3 format, and you can visit our website at www.acflaw.org if you'd like to listen to that. Also, CLE credit, again, is available. You can email koconnor@acflaw.org for that. Thanks again, Professor Swire. We really appreciate it. Thanks.
My great pleasure.
Listeners.
Okay, bye.
And that concludes today's conference call. We appreciate your participation.